Welcome to the Next Level Income Show, where it's our goal to take your income, investments, and your life to the next level. I'm your host, Chris Larson. You can get a free copy of our book at nextlevelincome.com/book, or just click on the book link. Today's show is sponsored by Money Insights and their Investment Optimizer strategy. In my book, I share how I use this strategy to invest my money in two places at one time. This is a strategy that has been used by the wealthy for generations for estate planning, minimizing taxes, preserving wealth, and increasing stability for their investments. And now they can help you develop a plan to build an emergency fund, pay for college, fund a business, plan for retirement, and even optimize your investments. You can find out more information at nextlevelincome.com/banking. I'm excited to have on today's show, Christian Andrews. Christian is the founder, CEO, and chief investment officer at Initiative Equity Partners. Bringing his vast experience in business leadership and his expertise in the real estate industry, it stems from countless transactions, investing in distressed promissory notes, wraparound mortgages, traditional fix and flips, and commercial partnership acquisitions. In addition, Christian currently sits on the board of Prolific Artists, a privately held institution with professors from Harvard, Juilliard, Yale, and NYU. Christian, welcome to the show today.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely, man. I really enjoyed, you know, our first conversation, hearing your diverse background. I don't know, a lot of people probably don't know, even a lot of my good friends. My mother was a music teacher and she went to Shenandoah Conservatory. Oh, so okay. Yes, it's really cool to have somebody with kind of an artistic background that has crossed over and blended their experience in the business world. So for our audience, maybe you could share kind of where you started and how you ended up where you are today.
Thank you for having me. So the beautiful thing is music is some way, specifically music theory, is connected to a very analytical side of the brain of thinking. And when you bridge that together to modeling, performas, discounted cash flows, and then you add anything that can go wrong, just like music and exploring possibilities in a theoretical point, it's a very close bridge, but most people are just not aware of that. And so the same part of the brain, I feel it's the same strength. And so that kind of just, obviously, way back then, that kind of just inspired me to take the next step of not being a broke musician, but in New York City. But yeah, it's been a pleasure to actually have music as the background film, which we're currently pursuing right now. And so it's very close. It's a closed world in terms of the analytical perspective. And sort of almost the relationships are similar in terms of the fundamentals of relationships. Nothing's really different. It's just the end result that you hear. That's the only difference to me. You know, that's how it seems.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And if you look at kind of, you know, I was a musician. I grew up playing string instruments, played the bass until I was in high school, and I kind of transitioned over into cycling. And I always thought it was interesting because, you know, you have the structure of music. You know, we composed. I'd go to music camp over the summers and we composed things. And like you said, I see a lot of similarities in one, when I was structuring my training schedules for cycling, you know, you have this macro perspective and it depends, you know, upon the, you know, really the cadence of the music. And the same thing, if you're training for a specific event, you have a different way of training. You have a different pattern that you follow. So I hear what you're saying. And I see, yeah. Is that a saxophone behind you there?
That is actually a saxophone. Yeah, that is. We now use it as dust collector, mostly. Yeah, no, it's when you're tasked with creating a three-part symphony and you have to divide it into three parts, much like Beethoven and Mozart, yeah. Or famous film composer John Williams, it's structuring a business plan. Three parts. What are the possibilities? How can they differ? You know, so it's building business plans is what you do every time you purchase real estate. You know, you got to know where you're going and execute it and who are the people, where's the team. And so it's just, like I said, it's the same concepts. It's just not by yourself.
Yeah. You know? So before we touch on what you're doing today and kind of what you've been doing in the real estate world, Chris, talk about the transition. So tell me about, did you study music specifically and then move into business, or when did that transition occur and what kind of sparked that?
Yeah, I did. I was studying music in New York City and I got sucked into film from a gig. A friend had this documentary that was going to Cannes Film Festival. And, you know, I just pretty much jumped ship and I'm like, okay, put those grades on hold and just went all in on film. And one thing led to another. And then I started getting to the film industry. And they don't tell you in the film industry, it's that it's like, it's partnership commercial real estate. I see it. It's on the
really?
Fund. You can't fund, you know, a $20 million picture by yourself. It's a partnership thing. And And sometimes on the fund level, just like private equity real estate, you know, it's 5, 8, 3 year holds with multiple films, the same exact measures, IRR, XIRR, you know, distributions. It's the same thing. But in order to get into that world, obviously, it's a closed club. You know, no one's going to let you in unless you really have a solid foundation of relationships. And so, you know, I got a little bit of the producing side, directing side, and really the business side and understand that. And that's when I actually came into contact with, you know, equity splits and all that good stuff and syndicated deals. And pretty much, you know, it's you need to diversify your income, you know, as a very good investor, it needs to know that 20% of the portfolio has to be sector specific. You know, you can't have one more sector more than 20%. And so it's very important that, you know, you don't take those hits during volatile times. And so interestingly enough, you know, if there is some catastrophe, which we now experience with the pandemic, a lot of things change, except streaming platforms, which went up, you know, like 200% every single
one. That's amazing.
One.
Yeah.
So that's our investors, you know, so that is a form of diversification that you're just relying on human behavior. You know, you want to be at a spot where, you know, human behavior we'll do the obvious. Sometimes humans are obvious. You know, it's like people are just going to be at home, you know, and sit and watch. So it's good to just have, like I said, not more than 20 and not rely just on one thing. And so I think film investors that just invest in film and real estate, commercial fund managers or syndicators that just invest in that one thing. Personally, like I said, Joe Biden passing rent control could really destroy a lot of personal portfolios. And so I think that's where diversification of really solid things of human behavior that won't get touched, you know, as Warren Buffett says, is there a moat around it? You know, can right. this be destroyed by anything else? And also, you know, you want to look at hopefully that sector that has some sort of free cash flow available, you know, money available at any moment in time. And film has a lot of that, especially a streaming platform like Netflix and HBO, lots of free cash flow. You won't find that a lot of that cash flow, you know, with someone like Tesla, for example, which is the talk of here, it, you know, that free cash flow does not exist. So
they might as well burn money, right?
Like exactly. Oh, you know, I got sucked into it and I was lucky enough to have a mentor that sort of gave me that advice very, very early on. And it just made sense. And here we are today.
Yeah. So tell us more about, so you started a fund that invested in films. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So I personally invested. I did not create a film fund. No, I personally invested.
Gotcha.
So obviously to run that a fund like that, you have to actually have really solid relationships with all the A-lister stars. That is mostly agents and managers. And so that's, yeah. So you got the outside investors and you got the agents who have the relationship. So that's
gotcha. That. How does that work? So you say, hey, I want to invest in a movie, right? So a lot of people, you know, they come to me and they've never invested in multifamily or any other type of real estate syndication. We walk them through it and we say, it's not really that complicated. It's not that different from going out and buying something yourself. We're just pulling it all together. Is it similar in the movie world?
Very similar. I mean, you don't, I would highly advise, especially in times like this, to not invest in single movies. You know, that's okay. Like a single family residential property. You don't really do that unless it's your own, right? So like I said, unless you're making your movie, the Chris Next Level Income movie, you know, maybe your life story, right? So like, unless it's your movie, AKA your house, then you do that. But when you're investing, you're not going to invest in a single family home. So that's the same thing. It's just the IR, it's just not there. There's a lot of things against it. You do sensitivity analysis against it, and there's 101 things that can go wrong and most likely actually goes wrong. So in terms of how the market responds, the project sale price is, I mean, even you're familiar with Christopher Nolan, Tenet, the new film. So it, you know, we're talking about Christopher Nolan, you know, legendary director here. And so again, the market just responds in different volatile times like this, kind of what's be a $1 billion picture. And, you know, it's not looking that way right now at the moment. So that's why I personally am against investing in one. So you actually want a group of assets, much like you don't invest in one unit, you buy 200 units at a time.
Yeah. It and decreases so, risk. Exactly.
And so those 200 units have power because even though they may be $110,000 a door, which $10,000 house is not the best house, but $110,000 unit, you know, combined with the 200 other ones, it's power, you got leverage, you know, your property values go up because it's producing income. So it's the same thing with the film. You got 15 or 20 films. They have lots of potential to really instigate this FOMO, what you would call fear of missing out from the actual acquisition companies. So Netflix, HBO, Apple TV, Walmart Plus, Paramount Plus, all these streaming platforms. Hulu just fighting for one another because they want that group of units, right? And so that's pretty much that. Like I said, it's only relationship driven. Not anyone can just invest in that asset class, which is a very interesting world. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that because you talk to any investor that invests in the stock market and some real estate, and you tell them you want to invest in film, they run away. And good reason, right? But when you tell them, hold on, this look at the returns of the last fund that sold to Netflix. And then on top of that, some you can sell the picture. You can do a lease option with
really?
A set of films. So Universal Pictures owns the films, doesn't want to sell them to Netflix. And okay. So leases them. Then that becomes portfolio income, right? Rents coming in. And then gives the opportunity to buy it at a seven given point in time to the streaming platform. So that's depending, you know, the rights and all that good stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of strategic. And so investors are just missing out because humans are natural consumers of storytelling. We want stories, we want to connect. We are driven by people's stories that are connected to us, that have experienced the same suffering as us, that have experienced the same probably lack of father, lack of finances, this, lack of that, you know, that. And so, and sometimes when we want to escape and we don't want to go the drama route, we'll obviously put on a Hangover Part 2 or a comedy. Just to escape a little bit, you know. What if I did that? What if I went to Vegas? But yeah, it's a great investment when invested right, when invested in the right packages, the right films, the right people, the right fund manager as well. And like real estate, you know, who's the sponsor? Who's sponsoring this thing? What are the returns? What have you done? Obviously, there, aside from actual monetary compensation, there's also a lot of other compensation with being involved in more benefits, you know. So those benefits are always great for, you know, relationships and other good stuff. And so, you know, it doesn't just stop at the monetary sector. Yeah.
You know, I tell people what we do in the real estate business, it's kind of like the Warren Buffett strategy. It's not sexy, just like Warren Buffett's not sexy. But movies are sexy, right? Any movies that you've been investor in that we would know of, Chris?
Yeah, a handful. Just a handful of them. I mean, right now we just invested in this new fund. Lots of Leo, you know, the DiCaprio picture, Brad Pitt picture. It's been great. I don't know what, obviously it's a 5-year hold. So we're going to see you know, what the returns are. Like I said, we're going to a new world right now, the AI world. AI is growing and growing by day. So as things get automated, obviously that has a little bit of in the streaming world. But yeah, we'll see what happens with this one. And yeah, I'm excited. We are also, you know, invest on personal films, try to sell that into a fund as well. And so it really just depends where we are at that time. But like I said, a lot of market volatility right now. So it's good to just have that 20% and look for the next sector. I think the next sectors are actually AI. Like I said, I'm just petrified of very liberal policy that are rent growth that actually don't benefit anyone. It's not, this is just benefiting landlords. Like I mentioned before, this is raise the standard of living and the beauty in which people live. And so it just scares me if any very extremist policy gets passed, and because it just affects everything. And so the reason that's why we started the new fund, the luxury fund, it's because it's in and out, and we're seeing a mass migration of about 3,000 people moving to Florida from New Jersey, Connecticut, New Hampshire, New York, all this wealth just leaving states because of tax policies, most weather, of course, no one wants that, you know, 6 degrees Christmas, it's too cold. But all this mass migration is really just pumping up those Florida numbers. And with this new luxury fund, it's such a short-term hold that it's in and out. We're not subject to any of the volatility of the government controlling the business plan. And so at this time, we're just focusing on that until, you know, maybe we'll see 24 months in where things stand, you know. And so that's the reason we're like, we jumped out of the curve. And a partner of mine, you know, we saw back February, we started seeing the numbers when COVID really kind of started, not so much in the US, but it started already. And we were just looking at any back door, trying to see if there's any layoffs that were happening. Layoffs will start next week, and boom, next week they all started. And so right there and there, we're like, multifamily, I don't know about this because the government gets involved. Of course, you know, it's always going to get involved. And so that's when we on board with the luxury fund.
Yeah. So I want to touch on that here in a second. So you're in New York City, right?
New York, yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't remember if you're in Connecticut or not, but you know, the rent controls, I talk to people about this. And so I live in Asheville, North Carolina. It's a pretty liberal city as well. And we have some, you know, low income housing. And the one thing that, you know, I've seen, and this is my personal opinion, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. We started out 5 or so years ago buying workforce housing, and people were concerned, like, are you going to kick these residents out? We said, no, we don't do that. We provide, you know, an improvement in the community. We provide a safer, better neighborhood, nicer place to live. People are willing to pay for that. What happens is you actually attract the better level resident or tenant, and those that are dangerous or don't pay end up leaving. So it ends up having this positive effect on the community and a positive effect for investors. My personal thought has always been when you implement rent controls like they have in New York City, you artificially suppress that rent, which increases the gap between market rate units or properties and that rent, which I think that has a detrimental effect because it's like increasing the gap so big that some people can't cross it. What are your thoughts on that, Chris? And again, not to get too political, but you know, just from an economic perspective, what are your thoughts?
Economic perspective, exactly. No politics in this. I mean, when you start increasing property taxes and you stop rent,
yeah,
the most obvious thing is to withhold CapEx and not do a lot of reparations. We need that remaining CapEx for any cash flow for any other emergencies, you know, just enough to keep the building surviving. And so, you know, paint starts chipping, this starts chipping. You're not going to take care of those new stoves and, you know, faulty stove. And you get so it's like now you're actually affecting people because you put rent control and you continue to raise the taxes at, you know, 1.6% per year or whatever it is. So like, what do you think it's actually going to have an effect on people? So it's sometimes really politicians don't really see the economic factor in that. I'm going to say this blanket statement, but there's not much financial literacy at the Congress level. You know, they have money, right? They have financial advisors.
Power, right.
Exactly.
And that's our goal. You know, that's our big mission at Next Level Income is financial education first. We have a initiative with a local group here in Asheville to help educate, you know, really younger underprivileged people that I think are the ones that are affected the most by this sort of thing. So let's flip to the other end of the spectrum. So this is a pattern that I've seen happening. People moving from, you know, high tax, high cost urban areas like New York City, like San Francisco, to lower cost, higher quality of living areas like the Southeast. Florida is a great example. So you're looking to capture some of this value and this opportunity that you see, Chris, with your new luxury fund. I love the name. So what's the model? Like, what are you targeting? I spent quite a bit of time in Florida, in South Florida specifically. I know we talked about that. I'd love to hear what you guys have going on down there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the aspects that's most important to investors is obviously that time value of money. And when you lock it up for 5 years or 3 years, it's losing value. And then when you introduce Jerome Powell into the, then we're going to have, you know, that IRR is not going to be as pretty when you got inflation attached to the 5 year hold, right? And so in the interest of investors and this mass migration that's going on, I mean, we also have lots of hedge funds and leaving the Connecticut and New York. And so a lot of the buyers of these luxury mansions that we're building are actual hedge fund managers and employees.
Really? Cool.
From there. One aspect of it. Yeah. So it's, you get all the wealth going and pouring into Florida and Miami, obviously, who doesn't love Miami? And we're constructing some assets over there, trying to get good prices on those lots or demolishing some homes and building brand new ones either waterfront or non-waterfront. So construction usually lasts between 6 to 8 months. And then depending on the actual design, it may sell in that 8th month we finish, or it may just in 6 months. But we actually don't want to sell before 12 months. We want long-term capital. Yeah, so short-term, we're just going to get hit with short-term, right? Yeah. So we want our investors to take advantage of any bonus depreciation we can get on new itemized items in the property, any accelerated depreciation. We want long-term capital gains. And we want to also offset some of those gains by using a beautiful strategy called a deferred sales trust. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Absolutely. We had a gentleman on, Brett Swartz, talk about that on the show. Fantastic. Fantastic body of knowledge Brett has. So if anybody's interested in that, take a listen to that podcast there.
Definitely go to Brett Swartz's website and just go talk to him. So knowledgeable. Such a cool guy. And so, yeah, we're preparing for that. You know, we don't want to get hit by this restriction of 1031, which actually forces you to make up a bad investment because there's a time limit, you know? I mean, the law of Parkinson says work expands to, you know, fill the time allowed.
Yeah.
Which is good. It's like, okay, I made a new investment, but when there's government involved, when other people's money involved, you need to really just buy low. That's when you make your money. When you buy is when you make your money. And so acquiring something that's rushed, it's always going to be a bad idea. So a deferred sales trust is usually what we want. And for our investors and for literally just anyone selling their business. I know that you have some listeners that are perhaps not in real estate, but they're business owners.
Absolutely.
If you're going to sell your business, don't get taxed. Do not get taxed. Avoid it.
Always options out there. And that's what I tell investors.
Really clear. I want to make, clear myself up here when I say don't get taxed for the general population. And, it's not that, a lot of entrepreneurs or real estate or investors want to avoid tax. Instead, it's just different from a country like Sweden or Denmark, where we see the actual effects of helping our community. I mean, I think you and I can both agree, we want to give money to our government where we see benefits. We want to reap those benefits, whether it's education for our children, maternity leave, all this good stuff. And so when we see those things happening in our community, of course, everyone will happily contribute. But when you have a lot of that money, they don't tell you where it's going, first of all. They'll take it away from you first because they don't trust you if you're a W-2 employee. They don't trust you, so they'll take it away. And three, a lot of it is going to the military. I mean, that's just a fact, just a complete fact. And so why not use the legal, law that's there to actually, if you're a business owner, don't get taxed on your business at sale, sell that business through the deferred sales trust, and then use that strategically to diversify into and create investment, really going to create passive income,
Absolutely. Yeah. The three tenets: we help you make more money at Next Level Income. We help you keep more money. We talk about tax strategy. And then obviously we're talking about ways to grow the money like today, Chris. But yeah, that's the big thing. I mean, hey, use the laws that the government, that the IRS rules have been put in place. Keep as much money as possible. You can always write a check to the U.S. Treasury if you feel so inclined.
Exactly.
Always. That's right. So if you feel like you're not paying your fair share, just pull out your checkbook and write a check to the U.S. Treasury. That's what I always say to people that say, we should pay more in taxes. I said, where's your checkbook? Write a check.
And here's the thing. There are about 6,029 pages of IRS code, right? And only a certain number, anywhere between 10 and 15, there's only those 10 or 15 dedicated to raising your taxes, while the other remaining 6,000 are dedicated to lowering your taxes. And those 10 only talk about that all gross income means any income generated from every source. That's all it talks about. And then there's a diagram, but all the remaining 6,000 are designed to lower your taxes, which means about 99% of the code is designed to save you money. People just are not inspired enough to save money for their children. I don't understand. Like, the code is there for you to take those exemptions file at the end of the year. Like, it's all there.
Yeah. And the government wants, you can look at it a couple of different ways, and that's a great point. And I think one thing that, I see is the IRS, the government wants to incentivize private individuals like yourself, like us, to go out and invest our money in areas that are going to help. And housing's obviously a huge one. So some people may be saying, Chris, well, you guys are building for these luxury products. So tell me, give me an example of the type of house, the size of the house, some of the amenities. I'm going to be like, I just built a house with my wife. My mouth's going to be watering, I'm sure, listening to some of the stuff you put in here. And the sale price, I'm curious, how's that look?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we strive for between the 3.5 to 4.5 million sale price. Yeah. Between 4,000 to 5,000 square feet. Obviously, build costs. If you're trying to build a property in Connecticut or New Jersey, there's just absolutely no way that you can build for any cheaper than 40% of a sale price per square foot. It can't happen in a lot of states. And my actually offers that opportunity where you can build something for 200, 250, 300 square foot and sell for 900 square foot. And so right there is where you see the, forget sale price, forget number of square footage. What's the build
that
price?
Spread.
What's the sale price per square foot? And you have that large of a gap, there's profit right there, right? And then you have a tax-friendly state in Florida, which has, long-term capital gains is zero. So it actually, on the state levels, it's actually even perfect. And so try building in Connecticut or New Hampshire, you just can't. And then obviously, or Wyoming, there's just no market there. Literally in LA, you're going to get hit with a state capital gains tax, which, by the way, the taxes are due at closing. sometimes. You know, you're not going to do that at the end of the year. And so it's really hard for other markets. And we see, you know, this type of asset class, if you really travel around the world, it just does not exist in the entire planet. I mean, it doesn't even exist in the country with the benefits that Florida has. The next luxury market I see is obviously Los Angeles with this type of asset class selling for $800, $1,000, $2,000 per square foot.
Right.
You know, it's Los Angeles, but that comes with its things, you know. And so we are really just fortunate to have Miami in a city like this that has such a huge gap of build costs and sale costs and really benefits our investors at a partnership level. This is obviously a community, a tribe, right? This is about a tribe together, right?
And, it's awesome. Yeah.
And the luxury builds, like I said, short-term holds. By the way, we also offer 12% pref, which is not common. Most real estate private equity firms are 6 to 8%. So we offer a non-compounding, non-cumulative 12% pref because it's such a short-term hold. We want 12% on your money right away before, you know, we as fund managers take anything. And so even if this deal goes south and it doesn't sell for the, you know, we're going to give you your 12% right away and an 85-15 split. You make all the money first before, and now if we're able to sell higher, then that's when the split will change. That's an IRR, but that's the investors. And we know that we're very vulnerable right now to what's going on in the country with any policies that can change. And so we saw volatility, and like I said, it's 20% of our sector. So we're going to take advantage of it. And when the time is right, we'll jump back into larger multifamily. We need to see what's going on. And that's the problem, like I said, from a financial perspective of running a country. It's just, the president needs to have some financial intelligent literacy, just an understanding of business, because this isn't about if Amazon or Apple wants to service the consumers. We are the consumers of the country. We consume the country. And as an existing subscriber to the country, yeah, there has to be incredible business handling and management at the top level. And so the president, all those people, it's just, you're running a business. You have CapEx, you have operating expenses and all these things. And so there's just no way that you can have any president without financial literacy run a country properly that also cares about people. It cares about minorities. It cares about policies, businesses. You know, the private sector always better than the public sector. And so it's very important that, you know, my tribe does not get affected by policies that are not business friendly, economically speaking, you know, so staying away from politics. And so that's literally what, you know, the idea we had in March, and we just saw those layoffs and this is not good, you know?
Yeah. Well, Chris, before you share with the audience how they can get a hold of you, how they can check out your luxury fund, what kind of projects you're working on, or maybe even scheduling that time to meet you down in Miami, if you could go back in time and give your 25-year-old self one piece of advice. It could be personal, enrichment, business advice. What would that advice be?
That's very interesting. I'm going to give this advice from a very analytical standpoint. That is having an understanding, benchmarking on your life. You know, we're talking about financial modeling, financial model your life. You know, the same way we spend and you spend a lot of time modeling discounted cash analysis and what's it going to take to really hit these goals and these target IRRs. I think I would give my life much earlier in that sense and stop wasting time on the thing that's not going to have an impact either on my happiness or my economic level. I think people have this bad relationship with failure and bad relationships with money in the instance that all money is bad, but money, as you know, is freedom. And most importantly, and this is the example that I set that I wasn't really truly seen when I was 21 or 22. I'll tell you a little story. So I was in college and I was in Union Square, if you know Union Square area in New York.
Yeah.
And I was on a bike, just biking around the area. And there was a girl right in front of me and she was also on a bike. And she, out of nowhere, a cab just hit her. Mm. And the bike crumbled. And instantly, she unfortunately actually died right at the scene. Paramedics then came, covered her body, and you know, everyone gathered in a circle. And I'm there, and I was just right in front of her, behind her. And this really kind of had an impact on me. And not only from the horrificness of the parents and her family, but also the cab driver's perspective on now his life just changes on that moment.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You killed someone. And these are obviously cab drivers who are also struggling to make ends meet. And so from an economic perspective, you know, if you or I or anyone is driving and is in the unfortunate position to hit someone on a bike, most people don't have the actual economic stability to survive legal expenses in this country. Yeah. Someone's going to jail if you can't defend yourself. And average millionaire today does not have enough money to legally defend themselves. So what do you think you need to do? You got to raise your income. You know, you got to raise revenue sources, diversify in things that you understand and things that you know produce a return. And so that's very important. It's not just for the safety of you. It's the safety of your family. It's the future. It's your legacy. And legacy is important. A lot of people don't see legacy as, you know, we're limited here in this planet for a very limited time. I think legacy is very important, the impact that we can have on people. And you cannot have impact without money.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I just finished a book called Die with Zero. And it talks a lot about that. If you haven't read it and you're listening, take a look at that book, Die with Zero. So Chris, I really enjoyed this conversation. I wish we had more time, but if the audience wants to learn more about what you guys are doing, your background, your projects that you have going on with the Luxury Fund, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Absolutely. So if you're interested in investing with us and partnering with us, our website is initiativeequitypartners.com, and you'll find one of the tabs, New Luxury Fund, on there, initiativeequitypartners.com. A little bit of our film side, our website is audacityinnovative.com. You can check out some of our projects there as well. And yeah, we'd love to have anyone come speak to us, reach out.
Awesome. Well, we'll have all that in the show notes if you're interested. We'll also have a link to our book, which you can get for free. Really enjoyed your story, Chris. Enjoyed sharing more about what you guys are doing, Initiative Equity Partners, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Appreciate it.